Well, let's pray. Lord, as we come to another session thinking about this text in Matthew, we pray that your Spirit is the one whose voice we hear most. I'm aware that talking as much as I am this week, it would be easy for my voice to be more prominent than it should be. So I pray that you would instead give us ears to hear your voice, and to hear your voice despite me, if that's necessary, and also to hear your voice certainly out of the text itself. Lord, help us to, as Calvin was so clear, to give ear to the word as it comes to us by word and spirit. Take what is the truth and seal it in our hearts, and do it in such a way that, in fact, it transforms how we live. For we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. I do want to continue on with Matthew in this section, and then we're going to jump to a little later section. Right after the occurrence happens in Matthew's gospel between Jesus and the Gadarene demoniacs, then there's the healing of the paralytic. And then there's a moment that I think in Matthew's gospel really does deserve its own pause, which is at verse 9 of chapter 9, regarding the call of Matthew himself. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And as he sat at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I have come not to call not the righteous, but sinners." Matthew, in every representation of Matthew in the Gospels, is just by designation as a tax collector, as you know, a kind of smarmy weasel, a person who is seen as somebody who is as unpalatable to Jewish sensibilities as anybody could be. The representation of everything that was ideologically, politically, religiously, secularly immoral. So the thought that Jesus, after having had, again, in Matthew's sort of lexicon, the leper, the centurion, the encounter at Peter's mother-in-law's house, would-be followers, stilling the storm, the Gadarene demoniacs, healing a paralytic, as if all that's not enough to make Matthew's point. Then we come to Matthew, and if you accept, as I do, that Matthew's authorship at least in part relates to Matthew, the tax collector, then this moment is really a profound moment. Now we're at the moment where Matthew, the one who's writing this story, is himself a person who's experiencing the significance of this counterintuitive, unexpected gospel. And it's this surprise and it's noteworthy that I think in the telling of it, it's exactly like the calling of the other disciples. Simply Jesus calls them and he responds. There's nothing more or less distinctive about Matthew than others. So clearly Matthew, the tax collector, the insider who sold out, right? Matthew is a Jew, but he's a Jew who's owned by Rome. So it's this incredible, unpalatable betrayal, this smarmy weasel who just exists right inside the tribe, who is one of us and yet has sold us out, and who is the one who manages the sellout day by day by day in the tax collector. And it's that person who is probably the greatest flagship of the alternative kingdom that Jesus has even given up to this stage, especially in social kind of society. Because Matthew, as a tax collector, would have had means, to some degree education, to some degree a certain amount of standing, and certainly a certain amount of power. But now it's Jesus who identifies with him. And again, in the other text, it's dramatic enough that he would touch a leper, but in the tax collector's case, it's a different thing. It would not have been an offense, an immoral offense, for Jesus to have had conversation with another Jew. But a man who was the tax collector, who he's now going to sit down at his table, is a way of intensifying again both the story and also the theme of what this whole section of Matthew is about. The scandal that Jesus and his disciples are sitting at Matthew's table is to make everybody's skin crawl. This is exactly the point, and this will only intensify even more as we go on in the gospel. But I wanted to pause there long enough to say, again, a great deal of our Presbyterian sensibility is that we just don't really want to have smarmy weasels in our midst. And we really don't want to particularly have a church of smarmy weasels. And we want to be sure that smarmy weasels are really clearly treated as the smarmy weasels that they are. But Jesus just doesn't do that. Like, no filter. No, like, come and change and no longer be a smarmy weasel, then follow me. There's no predilection before this. He just says to Matthew the tax collector, not Matthew the tax collector who's seen the light, who's repented of his tax collecting abuse, who's paid off all of his former debts, who's gone back to all the people that he's financially abused and paid off the kind of conniving outcome that he had managed to persuade them to participate in. None of that happens. Just straight on. Then he came to Matthew the tax collector, follow me. He does. And the next thing we see is Jesus and his disciples sitting at Matthew's table. This is just so amazing. Well, it gets even more amazing later in the gospel. So it just continues. It's just the continuation. And again, the domestication, the familiarity of the story. Oh yeah, Matthew tax collector. It's like, you know, the stories of the Bible that are imprisoned on the flannel board. This is the nightmare of the Bible, right? This is the nightmare, the potential nightmare of what Sunday school does to domesticate the gospel. I have a theory that one of the greatest domesticating influences of the gospel is actually Sunday school. And it's not because of children. Jesus does and says lots of things that children are very prepared to handle that are anything but comfortable. But we've created this kind of culture of Sunday school, which actually takes these stories that are anything but, frankly, child play, and we've turned them into something that's palatable, and then we think that somehow people are supposed to live off of that as real, authentic disciples who mature in a world of extraordinary complexity where the challenge of being bold, courageous Christian disciples is supposed to be fed off of Bible stories. And there are lots of people who just fundamentally think, I got the Bible stories. I heard the same ones every year for 12 years. And if that's what's supposed to actually help me be a disciple, I don't think so. So maybe discipleship isn't really for anything but the meek and the mild. Not the people that are actually in the places of great challenge. And I do think we need to look at the implications of what we're talking about here for children and youth, not just for the implications of this for adults. I think that, again, it's really easy for us to take the structures, the implications of the sociology that we live, and let that define the gospel, rather than the gospel to define the sociology. It's a complete inversion. And again, that's what all of Matthew is decimatingly doing. Okay, so let's flip over to... you know, the thing is, I just love all these chapters so much. Okay, I just want you to look as we slowly turn the pages. Just look, in light of what we're talking about, just look at the things that happen in Matthew. Okay, let's, because I want us to jump onto what's happened, but in between is just worth noting. So we come to the end of chapter 8, and we're now in chapter 9, and after this, then there's the question of fasting and this issue of what it really means to actually look on the outside, you know, to pertain to things that really matter most, rather than to create a kind of illusion of spirituality. That's just the core of fasting. I'm just going to be drug into this and try to give way too much detail. Okay, so then there's the restoration to life of a woman that's healed again, the healing of two blind men, heals one who is mute. The harvest is great, the laborers are few, the calling of the rest of the 12, then the invitation that the mission of the 12 is meant to express the kingdom of God in the same way that Jesus himself did. Then immediately the word about persecutions, who is it that's really worth fearing, all of that section. I've come not to bring peace, but a sword. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and one's foes will be members of one's own household. That's an interesting reversal right there at the end. Whoever loves father or mother rather than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves me or son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. Now again, when I first read these words coming out of the background that I did, where my father had instilled in me this incredible suspicion against religious authoritarianism, you can imagine the way that my skin just crawled reading those words. It was like, this is exactly what Dad's talking about. This sort of totalizing, encompassing, swamping of life in which everything is lost, and you lose your own liberty, and you lose your own understanding of the world around you. And my father and I, after I did become a Christian, had many, many conversations over the years about Christian faith and about why he wasn't a Christian and why he wasn't a Christian and why his doubt really trumped any possibility of faith for him for many years. That did actually change in the last 5 years of his life, but not for many, many years before that were there all these challenges. And I remember my dad just saying to me, in the way that I had remembered saying, even to myself, if this is true and I trust it, it will change my life. And I just don't want that to happen. And when, after many years of conversation with my dad, it finally came down to that. And I said, well, at least now, Dad, it feels to me we've actually hit pay dirt. It will change everything. That's what the kind of gospel this is. And I'm only beginning on the road, but it certainly is going to be the case. So again, Jesus continues the same sort of thing, plucking grain on the Sabbath, the man with withered hand, his chosen servant, this language of Jesus as the suffering Messiah, the proclamation of being the one who's going to proclaim justice to the Gentiles and to actually bring it into being. Then again, so many other stories along the way, the influence of the parables and the work with the crowds. Now, he does a lot with crowds, as you know, but one of the things that's true in Matthew's gospel, and it's true in Luke as well, is this very strong emphasis that Jesus ultimately does seem to specialize in the ministry of the one. The ministry of the one. And to me, one of the ways through the thicket of being paralyzed by the things that we're talking about here is that I'm not actually meant to somehow think that I'm meant to do this in a broadcasting way, as though in the infrastructure of all places at all times, in any place that I go, that I somehow could ever even begin to think that I could make that large body change. But what I can do is actually have a ministry to one. And in the end, while there is institutional influence that I have as a pastor, the most significant things I think that have happened at First Press in the times I've been there has all been about personal ministry. That's why preaching ministry and individual pastoral ministry are so integrally interlinked. I do have a voice to the community, but I only have a voice to the community that's authenticated in the most profound way, if in fact I also have a life with them that's actually a part of this. And I do think that that's where the rub comes, right? So I don't get the prerogative of standing in the pulpit and proclaiming something that I'm not also meant to actually enact. And what frees me from paralysis and from a feeling of all this is just too overwhelming is to say, well, I can't do this on my own life, personal life, fully and completely. I certainly can't imagine doing that in a congregation. What I can imagine doing is having a relationship with a person in a context in which the possibility of some of this transformation actually occurring seems much more likely. Part of the DNA of the International Justice Mission that I mentioned earlier is that while there is a recognition and a deep respect for the work of many secular human rights organizations, so many of them work at the level of the large demographic survey of what it is that's really occurring. That work is really needed to inform our understanding of what's really happening in the world. But in the end, when International Justice Mission was founded, it was not to simply go in as a kind of body politic and establish justice in some sort of vision in Cambodia or Thailand or India or wherever it may be, but instead to go in and actually respond to the suffering of a person. So IJM is unapologetically focused in its core ministry on the rescue of people who are victims of violent oppression. Now suddenly the large demographic of the million children that are trafficked every year in sex trafficking around the world becomes the story of the one child or the particular group in a certain part of a certain sector of Chennai or wherever it may be, and where in that neighborhood, in this brothel, when this girl by this name actually tells her story, so that enough that they can get the traction and the evidence and the proof to actually then be able to go in and rescue her with the particular details. Now, the human rights community, some of them, certainly initially and even today, look at IJM and say, this is just too disruptive. This is too unfair. It leaves behind the people that aren't rescued. Many of them return anyway. There's a kind of incredible recidivism rate that can exist if you don't have sufficient aftercare, all kinds of things. And IJM continues to say, no, but the thing is, even though we can't change everything, we can change everything for one person. And it's worth doing that rather than to be paralyzed. It's worth making whatever contribution we can make to the one that we can actually reach and get out, rather than to say, because we can't change the nature of human trafficking and stop it all over the world, therefore we're just going to benignly let 28 million people be enslaved in the world today. No, that's a staggering statistic. But what we can do is rescue the one family, the one individual, the one circumstance, the one brothel, the one rock quarry, whatever it may be. So, and Jesus, I think, is obviously the one who sets this in motion. And part of the deep integrity, I think, of the Christian faith and Christian witness and Christian ministry is the ability to remember both the crowd and the individual. Jesus never suggests one is more important than the other, but he also doesn't neglect one to the expense of the other. And there is a sense of broadness that we're meant to be engaged in, and there's the sense of the singularity. So I think in terms of our own discipleship and in terms of the discipleship of our congregation, a lot of it has to do with an acknowledgement that we're constantly moving between the one and the many, and not allow them to become the enemy of the other. Actually, to acknowledge that both have their place, and we have to figure out in the calibration of our own energies, where are we going to give ourselves to the one? Where are we going to give ourselves to the many? And in that process, I think it breaks some of the logjam. Okay, so we now come to the story about the death of John the Baptist and the anxiety that's all around those events and the playing on power and this seduction of that whole scene. Then we have the feeding of the 5,000, this amazing experience of God's provision. Then we come to this really wonderful moment in chapter 15 where there's this first significant and somewhat more extended collision between Jesus and the Pharisees in chapter 15 that begins, "Then the Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, 'Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders?'" Why do they toy with the crust, right? That's really what's being asked. "For they do not wash their hands before they eat," unlike being at Mount Hermon. "He answered them, 'And why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever speaks evil of father or mother must surely die. But you say that whoever tells father or mother whatever support you might have had from me is given to God. Then that person need not honor the Father. So for the sake of your tradition, you make void the word of God." Again, this tension that Jesus is trying to emphasize the reality, not the crust or the tradition around it. "You hypocrites, Isaiah prophesied rightly about you when he said, 'The people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines.'" Then he goes on to talk about the things that defile. So this whole early section is about this incredible sense of, again, just like in the Sermon on the Mount, calling us to genuine righteousness, to practiced holiness, practiced public holiness. That's really what he's trying to do. We are meant to be and to live in the world out of this holiness. And then I love this next section because it just typifies precisely what Matthew's been doing all along. "Then Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And just then a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, 'Have mercy on me, Lord, son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon.' But he did not answer her at all. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, 'Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us.' He answered, 'I was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.' But she came and knelt before him, saying, 'Lord, help me.' He answered, 'It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs.' She said, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table.' And then Jesus answered her, 'Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish.' And her daughter was healed instantly." In my interpretation of Matthew, what's happening here is that Jesus is enacting a parable. He's just been talking to the significant leaders of the day about what constitutes real holiness, about the way that the tradition rebuffs the purposes of God in the world. And now I think he actually, in a temporary way, enacts that with this woman. She comes into the scene as this screaming Canaanite woman begging for a demon-possessed child. This is like one of the moments that happens in Berkeley where someone who truly is a person stricken by both a mental illness, a social condition, there's all kinds of pariah-like realities that exist in Berkeley and probably in your town as well. And people like that then suddenly just inserting themselves in the middle of some glorious liturgy that we may have attempted. And right in the middle of that screaming mess is the reality. And the question is, now what are you going to give to this woman? And the question is, Jesus, I think, is really, I think, playing against the backdrop of what's just occurred, where he's talking about you're giving yourself to tradition rather than to the reality. And it's as though he says, in fact, listen how it plays if that's what you do. And what he initially gives to the woman three times in a row is sort of this declaration of, this is what would happen if I lived in the reality that you're offering. I'd say, no, there's no place for you. I'd say, no, there's no reason that I should give you bread. I'd say, no, just go away. And three times she relentlessly pursues. And then he does what he's already done before, which is to heal, to respond, to serve, to love this woman. I think what he's created is this living parable. Do you want to see as a mirror what it looks like to be people who live in an encrusted tradition? You have a person screaming in your midst out of desperation and active faith, longing for an evidence of a real spiritual reality. And if you were to give them what you have, this is what you'd give them. Tradition, tradition, tradition. Exclusion, exclusion, exclusion. No wonder when we read this text and don't think that we understand it, at least in the way that I'm suggesting, it can feel so offensive. It's meant to feel offensive. It's meant to feel scandalous. And then Jesus says, this is extraordinary. I hear and see and trust your faith, and I give you what you've asked. Go, it's been done for you. He lands where he wants us to land. Do we have to go through the layering of the traditions? Or can we dare to see that if we respond and give people that, we've given them nothing, worse than nothing? Then we come to chapter 16. Now, this same theme of the yeast of the scribes and Pharisees, which Jesus talks about in chapter 16, is so significant. I'd like us to think about the fact that it really begins, this chapter begins with a warning, then it's the raising of two questions, and then a surprise. The warning is first about avoid, I warn you against, watch for the yeast of the scribes and Pharisees. The Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test Jesus, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. He answered them, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. Then he left them and went away. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus said to them, watch out and beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. They said to one another, it is because we brought no bread. And becoming aware of it, Jesus said, you of little faith, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered, or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How could you fail to perceive that I was not speaking about bread? Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. Then they understood that he had not told them to beware of the yeast of the bread, the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This has a little bit of the flavor of The Office about it to me. It's like a dynamic at The Office, right? It's this feeling of the utterly clueless with the adamant sense that they exactly get it. The earnestness that is completely dull to the reality that's actually happening. They so think they get it. They just are so confident that they're the ones with the inside track. And then, in fact, they're the ones that are shown up over and over and over again to be the clueless. Like, we dealt with the bread thing. Like, get over the bread thing. The 5,000, the 4,000, remember, like, I've got bread in hand. I am not worried about bread. That is not my deal. My warning to you is the yeast. And what is he talking about? The yeast is the same thing that I think is exactly what he talks about later when, again, in the story of the fig tree, where Jesus curses the fig tree. It's the lack of the evidence of fruitfulness. The yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees is the yeast of tradition. Each different. The Pharisees' tradition really depends a lot on the law. The Sadducees' tradition depends a lot on a kind of political destiny. Both are yeasts which expect a certain fruit. In the case of the Pharisees, it's that the law will produce righteousness. In the Sadducees, it's that political action will ultimately yield a kind of a new political system in which finally the messianic ruler will lead and guide Israel, and they will be free from the kind of problems of Roman domination. Both are a yeast which will produce a fruit which is not the outcome that Jesus is looking for. You're giving yourselves passionately to the wrong thing. Don't abide with their yeast. Don't let that be your yeast, as though you think it's about your own spiritual management or as though you think it's about your own political outcome. The kingdom of God has different yeast, and it produces a different quality of life. So there's a very serious warning. And again, I think in our own theological and spiritual disciplines, we can easily suggest to people that they rely on the wrong thing. We need to be very self-critical about what is it that we're actually calling people to rely on, and how is that linked to what we think are the outcomes that God is really seeking. It's very easily possible for us to rely on simply our own human capacity, which I think is really the instinct of the Pharisees, even though it's done in God's name, or our, for religious reasons, or in the Sadducees' case, in our own political instincts, which is more their temptation. And in either direction, there's a tendency to simply allow it to be too human-centered, for it to be too humanly productive, for it to be too humanly managed. The kingdom of God, clearly in the language of Matthew, just will not come about as a result of those things. One of the greatest problems for our church at Berkeley is that we have too many people with too many gifts. There are just too many people that have too many gifts. There's so much competence. We could have a church that's competent and has nothing to do with the kingdom of God. We could have a church that does all kinds of magnificent programs and has incredible an incredible expression of activity, and it could have nothing but the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees about it. It could be all about ourselves. I often find that this is sometimes the most evident to me when I try to eavesdrop on our own and on other churches telling their story, and especially telling their mission story. We went and we did this. And it's really a story about us. And it's really for us, actually. So that then we can say, and we went and we did this. Oh, we were so good. And there's this incredible self-congratulations. There's just an incredible danger there. We have unbelievable power at our hands. Whatever our church's size, measured on a global scale, we are powerful people with powerful resources. And we can so get it wrong and give ourselves to the power of our culture rather than actually to the power of the kingdom. Being self-critical about that is the warning that Jesus is giving his disciples here. Don't think it's about bread. Don't think it's about human management. It's not. It's about what the kingdom is going to do that's going to yield a different fruitfulness. And that is a huge, hugely important thing. Then again, the text that is really the hinge in the whole Gospel of Matthew's narrative actually occurs, as you know, in the next set of verses. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. As we've all no doubt preached on this text many times, there's this dual set of questions. First, who do people in general say that I am? And then the more penetrating question, who do you say that I am? Obviously, the centerpiece of this telling of the gospel hinges on our response to that question. And what happens from this moment on, as we'll see in just a minute, of course, is that Jesus, from this moment, turns everything toward Jerusalem. If Jesus is who he says he is, and if the reality of that has now been affirmed and claimed, then it's going to be on the road to the cross that the rest of the story is going to be lived. It all turns on who he is that's actually dying, not just on the dying. Now, here, that affirmation is not just who he is as a general idea, but who he is personally, who he is to you and to me. And as I said, for me, this text was the text that I'm sure was the primary one that God used to finally speak to me. And part of the ongoing need for evangelization in the world and in our own churches is to really get at, have we truly answered that question? And have we answered it not just in the confessional sense of being able to answer the membership question, but have we answered it with our lives? This is clearly what the whole of Matthew is on about. Are we actually answering that Jesus is the Messiah with our whole lives? And then on the basis of that faithfulness, then that faith, then Jesus says, interestingly, he says, "I will build my church on the grounds of that." Not now, Peter, go and build a church that confesses that. Instead, he says, "I will build my church on the grounds of that confession." It's God's church. 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 It's not yours. It's not mine. It's not our denominations. It's not the Pope's. It's not anybody's except Jesus's. And there's a sense of ownership, participation, and active tense verbs that define who it is that's actually the Lord of the church and how that lordship is meant to be lived out. Clearly, that's a very significant part of this whole sense. And yet, right alongside that, this is where Reformed and Arminian theology has such an interesting time with these next set of verses. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Now, we talk gladly about the keys of the kingdom, but we tend to talk about them in a way that is ultimately deferential toward the providence of God, if we're in the Reformed tradition. In the Arminian tradition, these same verses are read in a much more activist sense, that we are actually the ones who hold the keys, that actually it really does matter what we do on earth with the keys that have been given. And in fact, that so much authority has been given to us that in fact it will show up in heaven. That's an amazingly salty thing. I love having really close Arminian friends because their instincts are grounded in a very different place than my own. And a lot of the passivity of the Reformed tradition, which is not the best of the Reformed tradition, but which is the fallout of the Reformed tradition, is a tendency to be too deferential to the activity of God as though it doesn't really involve us having real authority. Again, in Matthew's vocabulary, there is no more important single word, I would argue, than authority to describe Jesus. And then Jesus here, and even more at the very end of Matthew, turns the keys over to us. And there is a sense that there is real authority that we are meant to exercise. So again, in terms of measuring the scale of the importance, the seriousness of the gospel, of the ministry that we've been given, we've actually been given real authority. We're not just sort of visitors in the house. We're not the people who occasionally get to check in. We're not the people who sort of hang out in the neighborhood knowing that really Jesus is the one who's in the castle, sort of like when the queen is at Windsor and the flag goes up the pole. No, that's like way too distant. You live in the house. You're meant to dwell in the house and live as those who dwell in the house and who have the keys to the house and to show up in this way that now, again, in my language of this new architecture, the spiritual architecture of the kingdom, which is an architecture that includes people in the house that we would never have expected. We've already seen plenty of evidences of that, that invites in, welcomes, seeks out those who no one would have expected to hang up and find in the house. That's the kind of way that we're supposed to exercise the authority of the keys. Are we doing that? Do we actually understand that real responsibility in that way has been given to us? These are the things that obviously are very significant in Matthew's motivation of mission, which we'll say more about. So, a warning, two questions, and then, from that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you." But he turned aside and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Then Jesus told his disciples, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? For the Son of Man is to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone for what has been done. Truly, I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Peter, ever the confident one, is clear that Jesus couldn't possibly really be talking about his own death. This is clearly something that needs to be removed as quickly as possible from the understanding of what Jesus' ministry is going to be about. So he just thinks a gentle word with Jesus on the side would be helpful. So he decides to take Jesus away from the disciples. You can imagine him sort of putting his arm around. Let's just get a few things clear. Somehow you went quickly from the Messiah thing to the cross thing. We're not going there really, Jesus. No way. That's just like, God forbid it. It couldn't possibly be. And in the language that I think is as strong as we find anywhere in the whole New Testament, certainly the strongest thing that is ever said to a disciple, it makes the condemnation even of the scribes and Pharisees later in Matthew 23 seem pale by comparison. When Jesus turns to Peter, the one who's just made the confession of him for him to be the Christ, and says to him, "Get behind me, Satan." Jesus could not use a more condemning phrase to describe the threat, the danger, the wrongness of what Peter's trying to do. He's trying to save Jesus from the cross. And if you save Jesus from the cross, then you may have saved Jesus from the cross, but you have condemned the world. And Jesus understands that, in fact, the cross is the central act to which he's meant to be given. And everything about his life and ministry has to be lived out in response to that, which is where he's turning. And then, in order to intensify it, he says, "And not only is it true that I'm going to the cross, but now in the way that's the most explicit that we've gotten anywhere up to this moment in Matthew's gospel, he says, and you, if you follow me, then you've got to take up your cross as well." Now this is, again, In Bonhoeffer's language, we have sold out to cheap grace. We've sold out to a sense that we're very happy, maybe, in sort of an antiseptic way, for Jesus to have died on the cross, as long as it has a yields a positive benefit for me that retains my social standing and my religious sensibilities, which themselves are off. But when it really calls us to not only go to the cross, but carry the cross, then we're really engaged in a completely different vision of what it is that we're supposed to be about. Have we actually cultivated? Are we cultivating cross-bearing Christians? This is a sort of language that, frankly, having grown up outside the church, is just sort of still foreign to me in a certain way to use. And yet the longer I live in the Gospels, the more I realize this is actually the language of Jesus. This is actually about cross-bearing discipleship. What we want is soft pews and, you know, easy turns and warm fellowship and really good coffee. We want Jell-O salads. We want that image that somehow is all about comfort food, rather than actually this cross-bearing life. Now, this doesn't mean that life becomes nothing but a veil of tears. The amazing thing is that, as the writer says in the New Testament, it was for the joy set before him that he endured the cross. So one of the things to retain in all this is not this kind of, you know, this dark kind of medieval Catholicism or weighty scholastic Calvinism that makes our spiritual lives just so about oppression. It's about how do you live an oppressed Christian life. That's not Jesus' vision of this. It was for the joy set before him. It was because of the extraordinary invitation into the life of the kingdom that Jesus goes to the cross, and that he says to us, and you, if you follow me, if you're going to be my disciples, then the marker of that is that you'll carry a cross, which is not about an incidental kind of suffering that may be yours in the flesh or yours as a consequence of your birth order or as a consequence of your psychological damage or your narcissistic wound or whatever it may be. All those may be burdens that we also have to work out. But I think cross-bearing is not about those things. Cross-bearing is about the free will election to actually identify with the suffering love of God in the world for the sake of showing and demonstrating that there is a God in the world who really loves people who are broken and lost and oppressed. Get the tape. One of the things that's so amazing to me about, again, the work of the International Justice Mission is the way that it's given me entree into stories and people and relationships that I wouldn't have known otherwise. And I want to just end by telling a story about this one woman named, a young girl named Elizabeth. Elizabeth had been raised in a hill tribe in Asia and had been taken by her aunt, who said to her mother that she was going to get her a job in the city. This is a classic sort of story that many of you will be familiar with. And of course, when they get to the city, then her aunt ends up selling her into sex trafficking. And in Elizabeth's case, I think it was about 16 months, she was in a brothel where she was first isolated, then serially abused repeatedly many times by the owner of the brothel, and then eventually became submissive and was one of the girls that was sold. She was very young at the time, a young teenager. And eventually IJM came to encounter Elizabeth. You can imagine the terror, the fear, the anxiety, the worry, the overwhelming darkness that's part of that kind of a story. How does a person like Elizabeth actually know that there's a God of love in the world? How will she know in an authentic way that there is a God who knows her name, who hasn't forgotten her, who isn't ignorant of her identity, of her suffering, of her need? It isn't enough to read a tract. Now, it's interesting that in Elizabeth's case, she was raised in a very deeply Christian family. There had been two generations, at least, in her family that had been very devoted Christians. And her father had been a village leader, a village Christian leader. So there was a sense that the Christian faith was really alive for Elizabeth. And when she was taken by her aunt, her mom truly did believe that what was happening in that case was that she was being given an opportunity to work, which would ultimately be able to pay for the education of her siblings. That was really, truly what her mother and father thought was going to happen. And even, frankly, to this day, Her parents don't know this whole story because of the shame and because of the anxiety that she feels they would feel over the events that actually unfolded. Now, when Elizabeth was found and first talked to by IJM, there was a text that was written, or something that was written on the wall over her bed, which turned out to be a biblical text, and which was a text that had been the text that when I first met Elizabeth earlier that week, I had just been preaching on this text. So I was struck when she wrote it on the wall in her language, and then later I heard the text translated, and it was this, above the bed on which she was so serially abused. She had written, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and foes, they shall stumble and fall." She knew in her own heart that the God named in this text did love her. But what would be the evidence of it? It was part her own psychological survival, and part it was her own resiliency in the face of this, her capacity just to breathe, just to try to somehow endure this serial abuse. Eventually, when Elizabeth is released from captivity, and she's now celebrating at this moment that I want to describe, her first year out, the woman that has been the closest to her with IJM is someone who knew that, in fact, her own life, which had been to be a senior investigator with the Justice Department, who graduated from Harvard Law School, who had every cultural privilege imaginable, who was truly on the fast track to a very significant position in a very prestigious Washington law firm, gave up all of that in order to, I think, choose to carry her cross, which in this case was the free choice to say, I want to identify with victims of violent oppression in the world who have no advocate. And as a result, Sharon gets involved ultimately with IJM. She's the lead investigator that brings about Elizabeth's release. She's also the friend that pursues and follows up Elizabeth in the early stages, and over the course of that first year, they were in constant contact. And so on the occasion where she's now going to help Elizabeth remember her release, they decided they were going to spend this day together, and they were at a certain park that Elizabeth liked to go to that was beautiful and renewing to her spirit. And Sharon thought, because of the meaningfulness of this text written on the wall, that what she wanted to do was to reread Psalm 27, because the cry of that psalm is a cry that God had heard. And Elizabeth said, no, Psalm 27 isn't my text anymore. It's now Psalm 34. "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Look to him and be radiant, so your faces shall never be ashamed. This poor soul cried and was heard by the Lord and was saved from every trouble. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Happy are those who take refuge in him." Elizabeth is very aware that she was one of the privileged few in the millions taken in sex trafficking every year who actually found their way out. How did she know that the Lord heard her cry? In her case, because of release. And how did the release happen? Because some people took the seriousness of the suffering of others more seriously than they took their own suffering, and chose to take up a cross, which ultimately led them to Elizabeth, which enabled her to be able to experience the delivering mercy, justice, and presence of God. And how are other people in the world meant to know that there is a God of suffering love, who wants to provide them with justice and deliverance and hope? Because the people of God take up their cross and go to people who are in suffering, oppressive need, and actually show up and demonstrate that God. Because, of course, that would be what it would mean to be a follower of Jesus, wouldn't it? Now, we think that often these issues are so remote and impossible and staggeringly large, and they have the potential of being seen only in those terms. Until finally we see them, I think, in the terms that are more like Jesus, where it really does come down to the one and to seeing the reality versus the crust and all the reasons not to do this. Instead, to just decide that the reality of following Jesus will involve a cross that takes up that reality and enters into the places of suffering and need. I was very moved when I heard that Rich Mao, not long after 9/11, had invited a group of Muslim scholars to Fuller and to spend 2 weeks there to study Protestantism in America, and then to use his outer office as their prayer room. So he had moved out all of his furniture, and this is where they prayed every day, in the outer office of Richard Mao, the president of Fuller Theological Seminary. As he was telling this story, I have to say cynically and with a kind of voyeuristic curiosity, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, I wonder if all the donors know this. I immediately started thinking of all the people who would find this offensive and wondered how he was handling the controversy that might have arisen as a result of this, not long after 9/11 especially. And so I had this really good friend who has served, a person whose life and ministry is in a Muslim setting, who is himself a Christian out of that setting, a person who's a significant Christian leader, and a person who has suffered at the hands of Muslims many times, been brutally beaten and imprisoned twice. So I went to him, who lives in not far away, and I said, have you heard this story about Rich Mao? And what do you think of it? And he said, oh, it's no problem at all to give them a room. We're supposed to give them our hearts. Right, I said, that was exactly what I was thinking. I was just completely captivated by the love thing. I was just thinking, what an opportunity to love. That was really what was absorbing my attention too. Yeah. We're not just supposed to give them an office, we're supposed to give them our hearts, our whole lives. I've got a long way to go. Lord, by your grace, help to take this word and let it be a word of life, a word of hope, a word about the joy set before us, a word of joy for us and a word of joy for the world, a word of joy for the churches that we serve and the disciples and discipleship that we want to encourage. Lord, none of us has this down. All of us are challenged and unsettled by these texts. May we live unsettledly before you as we seek to work out our salvation. To the glory of your great name, we pray. Amen. We have a few minutes for question and discussion, so fiery darts or otherwise. Yeah. Yes.
Been really inspired by your messages, the challenge, the invitation to go from complacency to compassion. How would you take a minute and comment on the scripture, where your treasure is, there is your heart also?
Yes. Well, it is interesting, as I'm sure we've all frequently observed, that Jesus starts with the treasure and then says your heart will go where the treasure is. So, and I think he is really talking about financial treasure. I think he is talking about financial resources, and he really does say, where we put our financial assets is where our heart actually finds its home. And not the other way around, that somehow we have our heart and our treasure will naturally follow. It's that our heart will follow our treasure. And clearly that's the case. I mean, our culture is built on that premise. Consumerism is all about people whose hearts will follow their treasure, and people become overwhelmed by this. Our church has had this fascinating tragedy to see this, when in the Oakland firestorm, 44 families had their houses and everything that was in them lost to the fire. So 44 families, you know, a couple hundred people were directly affected by this in our church. And it became an opportunity eventually, not obviously in the first months or even the first year, but eventually to have conversations with people who had literally lost everything. And to say, okay, now you've been through this tragedy, there's lots of things that we've tried to do to respond to that, but now we need you to be our teachers. What happens to you when your treasure is lost? Where has your heart gone? And I have to say that now, even this many years on, which is now, 20 years or so after that firestorm, People are still processing that experience and the significance of it, and it's been an interesting window into this process. So the challenge that we've tried to encourage in our church is to encourage a clarity about what Jesus is saying, and then a process of kind of taking stock in a way, doing a kind of analysis or a kind of prayer of examine around financial resources. And the most recent economic crisis has created a further opportunity to do that. So part of what we've done is to acknowledge that there's a need for practical response in some family circumstances. But in other cases, it's an opportunity to realize fundamentally, even if there's been significant financial loss, the more significant thing is what's happening to your heart now that there's been financial loss, and where are you prepared to go, and how do you make sure that your riches are actually in the place that you want to believe your heart's going to go, and where do you need to shift your assets to diversify your portfolio for the sake of the kingdom, not just for the sake of a better economic advantage. So I guess what I'm saying back to you is more just a cluster of things, a conversation that we've tried to as openly as possible encourage, realizing that a lot of that has to be worked out in individual circumstances. There's a wonderful curriculum that Tim Dearborn of World Vision has written regarding money and loss in these particular economic times. And I think if you go to the World Vision website, you can find it. I think it's there. If you can't, I'm not really wanting to respond to all your emails, but if you want this curriculum, I'll try to find a link to it and send it to you. It's a very helpful thing in dealing with just these kinds of concerns. Certainly we're aware as a church that we have to figure that out as well.
I'm a little afraid of the answer to this question, but you skipped past 9:17, the new wine and old wineskins.
Yes.
This is an incredibly challenging series of messages you're giving us. Are we so old that this wine isn't going to work, or what help?
Well, clearly, I think Jesus, in the original context, is referring to Israel. Whether the church, in a contemporary way, is the parallel to that, I suppose, is probably something that has to be answered on the ground. I would find very little intrinsically about the PCUSA that I would say, from my point of view, intrinsically holds the new wine I'm talking about. But I'm not saying that it's not present at all. I think there's lots and lots of places in congregations and even in some presbyteries, in places nationally and internationally, where I think there is plenty of new wine and where it really is being poured out and where they're simply making it up. But how they're making up the wineskin as they go. But I think whether or not we've sort of presumed the new wine must be there in this wineskin. And I think that's completely fallacious. That's not true. If it's really the new wine, then we should never be presumptuous about its presence or believe that its container is sufficient, especially if it's as powerful a substance as I'm suggesting that it actually is. So I think that it's a mixed picture. I don't think there's a uniform way of describing it. I think there's pockets of faithfulness, deep faithfulness, in Israel, right? There's places in Matthew where it's clear that Jesus does hear, in the context of Israel themselves, deep faithfulness. Clearly, the apostles are actually represented as an expression of that faithfulness within it. But yet, as that faith is affirmed, there's also a supplanting of the old by the new, and then we're on to an entirely different structure. And I do think the complacency, the assumption, the presumption of an established mainline denomination bears potentially all of the hallmarks of Israel's problems and then some. So it's a mixed picture. Yeah, right. Yeah, the book Not for Sale by David Batstone. It's a wonderful book about human trafficking. I really would highly commend that. I'd highly commend a film that's not yet really out on DVD, but I would encourage you to watch for it, and you can find information about its showings online that's called Call and Response. It's Call Plus Response. That was done by a really amazing guy who lives in Berkeley, actually. And it's a terrific, terrific film that basically is like a combination of documentary and Live Aid sort of concert, not done in a concert venue, but where there's performances by various contemporary rock stars who then who perform, and then there's reflection by people about the nature of human trafficking. And the music and the telling of the story are interplay really amazingly. And so I would really, really encourage you to take advantage of that. Gary Haugen's book, The Good News About Injustice, is really helpful. His second book, Terrify No More, is also really good. And his third book, Just Courage, is also a very, very fine book. Yeah.
There's a new church development in our area that is as a weekly giveaway. Okay, there's a new church development that has a weekly. Yeah, I don't think it's on.
New church development in our neighborhood that has a weekly giveaway, gift cards to Cold Stone, ice cream, Starbucks, whatnot. They give away a Wii also. A lot of people in my church said, I want to go over there and put my name in for the free Wii. I'm wondering, not many, but occasionally people suggest that methodology might be useful in our efforts to kind of reach our neighborhoods, communities, et cetera. What do you think about that methodology and other things kind of related to it in relation to a ministry that seeks to have the cross at the center? Are those things absolutely incompatible, or is it just sort of semantics, and it's possible to use those methodologies to kind of lead people to the cross?
Right. Do the means justify the ends? And is there the possibility that a person getting an ice cream certificate might come to church, learn about Jesus, and become a serious disciple? That can happen. God will choose to use what God will choose to use, including that. If you're asking a different question, which is more a sensibility about, do I believe this has authentic congruency with the gospel, I'd say no. And what the world actually, I think, is longing for is the evidence of the kingdom, not the evidence of coupons. So part of what we're trying to get at there, I think, is to try to live in a really peculiar way. So how can the church in your community find some way of extravagantly giving away the grace of God's love? This is clearly one of the things that was so profound when the Amish killings happened, right? This astonishing evidence of a forgiveness. That's just unbelievably peculiar. Where does that come from? Is it denial? Is it just a cultural myopia? Is it an unwillingness to actually tell the truth? Or is it actually a culture with the capacity to forgiveness? Now, because I've actually studied Amish culture and religion and theology quite a bit, I have huge skepticism about a lot of Amish practice. But what I don't have a skepticism about is the authenticity of their forgiveness. And that clearly is like one of those things that lands in a culture and clearly creates waves. So where are we choosing to do that? I remember when Jerry Falwell, God rest his soul, was calling for a boycott of all the stores that wouldn't allow businesses to, or the stores rather, that wouldn't allow their local expression of those stores to put up Merry Christmas signs, right? And he said, so don't boycott any store that any store that won't allow you to put up Merry Christmas. And I thought, no, what we need to do is boycott every store in order to take all the money that we would actually use for Christmas and give it away. Now, that would be a witness to the culture in an entirely different way that turns everything inside out. I realize, economically speaking, for all kinds of reasons, it has its intrinsic challenges, but that's exactly its appeal to me. So it's this feeling, it's this sense of, let's do something that no one would really expect anyone to do because it's so non-self-centered. It's not about getting you to come to my church. It's about actually giving something away to a world that needs the things that we actually have to give, like real forgiveness. Like the real capacity to engage in for example, in South Africa and in northern Uganda and in Liberia, many places, this sort of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that have occurred in these various places around these extraordinary atrocities. And part of the church has peculiarly sought to witness to its faith there is they have no social power. What they have is abundant spiritual power to actually learn to tell the truth, to encourage people to actually name and confess the reality of their sin, to let that be named and accepted for what it really is, and then to provide a means by which that real sin can be truly forgiven. Now, that is a culture-changing thing. Let me commend Andy Crouch's book called Culture Making. It's a really marvelous book, and one of the things that he does is that he takes the sort of Niebuhr paradigm, and he adds something to it, which Niebuhr doesn't really do, and that is that he talks about, in addition to all the other ways that the church might relate to culture, he says the most important way that the church is meant to relate to culture is that it's meant to be culture creating. And by that, what he's really referring to is the positive cultural good that the church brings into a place and actually creates for the welfare of the city. This is exactly Jeremiah 29. Plant gardens, build houses, marry, have children, and then, most significantly, seek the shalom of the city, for in its shalom will be your shalom. So, to me, the irony of that is, I want you to give me your shalom by your presence and your participation in my church. What I think Jeremiah is talking about, what I think Jesus is talking about, what Andy's talking about in his book, is this sense of, I want to seek the welfare of the city who are my enemies. This is this to say, I seek the welfare of Babylon, because as Babylon thrives, then we as Israel, exiles in Babylon, will thrive. But it doesn't happen the other way around. And that's part of the purpose of living as exiles. And we live as consumeristic people in Exodus. This is a theme of mine, this sense that the church in America is defined a lot as an Exodus church. It's a church that's escaped other places and then established America as the promised land. So a great deal of our cultural and theological and spiritual life is really about leaving someplace behind and actually fleeing the enemy in order to come and be the good people in the good place. Some people thought it was New Jersey. Other people kept deciding to move west, thinking that maybe Jersey wasn't the promised land after all. Some people think it's the Midwest. Some people think it's California. Some people think it's Berkeley. And in that context, we then cultivate, nurture, buy, remodel our way into the promised land of our own design. And American Christian culture is all about fashioning a paradigm of your own Exodus promised land. I think, in contrast to that bastardization of an understanding of Exodus, which is still a very functioning and important paradigm, alongside that, Jesus, I think here in Matthew and Paul and many other places, refers to actually life that understands that there is a coming out and a transition into the newness, a leaving the dark and coming into the light. That is all a very significant part. John, again, the significance of a new birth. All that is extremely important. But alongside that is the peculiarity of living as exiles, as strangers in a strange land, as people who are actually doing justice for the sake of your enemy, not just leaving the enemy as in Egypt behind in Egypt, but now in Babylon. Not trying to escape, not trying to find some way out, actually dwelling as God's peculiar people in Babylon as exiles, doing the salty things that are so counterintuitive to do specifically for your enemies. Which is why it turns out that Matthew is so significant, because I think Matthew is the paradigm of this kind of exilic life. Do you want to know what it looks like to live as peculiar people in a peculiar place? Live the way Jesus teaches in Matthew. That's what's so countercultural. That's what makes all of Matthew such a surprise and such an affront. That's why we've tended to flee to John, because John doesn't teach us that in the same way. John gives us tremendously important theological and spiritual life. Obviously, I'm not intending genuinely to put one against the other. I'm just saying that we need to let all these voices be found. And Matthew's voice is often quieted because we just, again, are committed to this domestication, which sometimes the comforting inner language of John allows us to do in a way that the public language of Matthew doesn't allow us to do. So this sense of public discipleship, salty disciples in an awkward place, strangers in a strange land, all that is just, that's exilic life. That's what we're meant to figure out in our church. And that's why it's hard. And then when it's hard, we cave and we go to the culture instead of cave and go to Jesus. So then we've really given up the ship. Then it has been an old wineskin. It has nothing to do with the kingdom of God. We might as well give it up.
Mark, would you mind commenting on your new call, particularly in light of what you've been sharing with us?
Yeah. This call to go to Fuller was completely outside anything I would have ever imagined. In fact, when Marguerite Schuster, who was the first one to contact me, she said what she was calling about, and I patiently listened for a few minutes, and I said, well, really, it's very nice of you to have called, but honestly, I'm just so not this person. I'm not Lloyd Ogilvy. I'm not a pulpiteer. I don't even necessarily believe there is such a discipline as homiletics. I'm not sure that anyone can be taught to preach. I just don't think this is my call, clearly. That's just like nothing that I can recognize as my thing. So I could give you some names of people that I think would be really good, but I'm just not that person. No, she said, we actually sort of knew that about you. We kind of had done our homework and we realized that this probably wasn't your thing, which is why we were interested in you. So I said, okay, well, you know, that's a little breathtaking, but okay. So then we began to talk more, and the position is two things. It's to teach, but then it's also to direct the Lloyd Ogilvy Institute for Preaching. And right now, that's just a kind of, it's a shell, really. There's two events that happen each year in that institute. There are each seminars, Preaching with Passion, which Lloyd himself does. But other than that, nothing else about the institute has been defined. So the director who comes in will define that. So I said, well, you know, let me just imagine what I would think of. I mean, where I would want to go is I would want to encourage the development of preachers for congregations of all different sizes in all different sort of settings who are committed to biblical exposition and who are called to proclaim a gospel in the context of worship, which is transformative of culture in the world and engages specifically in measuring that through the lens of whether the church in the world does justice. Great, they said. That's what we'd love to have you do. I said, no, but really, this isn't like playing the preaching thing. I mean, I'm not into performance. I'm not into preaching as an art form. I respect people, those traditions. They are even in the faculty. They will be my colleagues. I get that. I'm just saying, out of my sense of vocation, that's not what I feel called to put my weight down on. What I feel called to put my weight down on is what I've been talking to you about, and which I would want the Institute to actually cultivate. How do we raise up? How do we stimulate in the sense of new pastors? How do we raise up a generation of pastors that has this kind of agenda clearly in their focus and in their sights and has the capacity to be able to communicate it to their congregations? But likewise, how do we refresh and renew and stimulate a lot of pastors in many settings who have been about pastoral ministry for a long time, who know the ordinary challenges of preaching, in a day, week in and week out in a congregation that may not have this on their radar at all, of all these different denominations, how do we stimulate that and encourage that to grow? And how do we do that in the context of a larger global conversation where this same sort of work is needed in the world? Well, all that is potentially the scope of what this institute will have in its sights. And there's money that's been raised, there's potential and desire for convergence with other people that are already doing work related to some of these themes at Fuller. There's a desire through the assets of Fuller, financially, but also in terms of its faculty and its capacity to gather people, that in fact there's a great affirmation of this sort of vision. So it remains to be seen. It's wholly unknown, but it's exactly on target with what we are doing here.
Yeah. I wonder if you comment on how you budgeted your time in order to live more missionally. What have you done?
Yeah. How have I budgeted my time in order to live more missionally? I suppose I've done a lot of things. I've taken time that is discretionary time that could be study leave time or could be, in some cases, vacation time, but obviously has to be worked through and felt is a joint thing with my family. But I've used those times to expose myself in reading, study, friendship, travel, to anything that's going to disrupt my world. I mean, essentially, I just really do believe the gospel is fundamentally an agent of disruption. And that what I mostly need most of the time is disruption, good disruption, which is not necessarily disruptions I would choose, happily, but disruptions that are real. And so I think all that is stuff that I've done. I think my devotional life has been affected by this, partly through what I was referring to of these images that I have on my computer that I use as a focus of prayer. Every day, my day typically begins by a time of prayer. Actually, it starts with coffee. Then a time of prayer. I read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and then I write about five letters to different politicians. I didn't ever used to do this, thinking that I somehow needed to be a master of policy, and I have nothing to suggest in policy terms. But what I can do is simply register a conscience, an active, compassionate, justice-oriented conscience. So we live in easy days where you can easily have people's emails simply fixed in your address book. And I have different people in government that I just regularly write. And I just say to them, hey, Condi, Mark again, just thought I wanted to tell you another word about Northern Uganda. Just really hoping that you're paying attention to what's happening in Northern Uganda. It turns out that I know these things from these friends of mine who are living and suffering in these circumstances. I hope that in fact, you're really making a response. Love and kisses, Mark. And I do this with lots of government authorities. So I have, you know, local, state, national authorities that I just regularly write to. It's said that email is not as effective as written mail. That's probably true, but I won't get one done and I will get the other done. So I'm going to do the thing that I can do rather than whine about the thing that I can't do. So I'm going to write. And I get responses regularly. I have regular email return responses. Most of them are pro forma, but sometimes they gather together. We've been gathering your letters and we have these things to say about the last 10 letters. So the thing is that what I'm doing is I'm not a political protester. I'm wanting to be a spiritual conscience. I'm not an advocate for you should do this as opposed to that. Sometimes I may have opinions about those things. If I do, I say it. But often it's not that. It's just like, hello, There's people paying attention to what's happening in these places where it seems as though nobody's paying attention. I know these things, I don't know those things, but I just hope that you, who should be really paying attention, because that is, I think, your job, are paying attention to the things that I think really matter. Here they are. And I'm going to try to tell you to them in as helpful and direct and positive a way as possible, and in as urgent a way as possible. So that would be an example, again, of feeling like that takes, I don't know, these are not long letters, these are not epistles, these are notes. But I suppose that maybe altogether takes an hour. And I see that as a launching of the day that helps me to position everything else that's going to happen in that day in this bigger context. Now I'm going to walk into a day of pastoral care and ministry and administration and study and all that with at least some things in order. I had a teacher at Whitman College, wonderful influence in my life, named Tommy Howells, this little gnome of a man who talked in very quiet voices. You had to always sit in the first couple of rows to be sure that you heard him. He kept a cryptic notebook fat and full of notes that were unintelligible, except to him. And he would speak, and he had this kind of gesture. He'd sort of talk like this as he began the day. And he'd sort of begin with about 5 minutes of wisdom. And then he'd say, now, friends, that the universe is in order, class can begin. And it was this moment, that moment, that I would say again, like so many profound teachers that affect your life, it's like, that's it. I want to live in those 5 minutes. And my 5 minutes will be a different 5 minutes than his 5 minutes. But if I don't see those 5 minutes framing everything that I'm doing, then class being in order is more likely to be class in chaos or insignificance. That's not what I'm to be about. I want the universe to be in order. And for me, that kind of spiritual discipline is a way of attempting to do that.
Yeah, Mark, I think a lot of us are trying to do the gospel to bring the gospel to people who already have everything. And as one of the roles of the Spirit is to convince the world of its sin and convict the world of its sin. I guess one of the things I struggle with is, in the words of The Who, we don't need to be forgiven. And when we're offering grace and forgiveness to people that don't feel like they need to be forgiven, what are the alternate ways of approaching the culture without simply selling their sin to them?
When I was at the Wayne Church, I had this experience of preaching through the Gospel of Luke, parts of the Gospel of Luke. And we came, of course, to the parable of the prodigal son. And it dawned on me as I was studying for that week's sermon that I was a pastor to elder brothers, and that I didn't know what the gospel to elder brothers actually was, and that I'm a prodigal, and that I understand prodigals. That's why I love living in Berkeley, and I have an instinct that gets prodigal life. I don't really understand elder brother life, actually. So I hadn't yet said this when a man in our church who attended a men's Bible study who studied the text that I was going to preach on the week before I preached on it said, hey, you know, we had this interesting thing. We were doing this Bible study. And I said to the men in our church, so you guys, how many of you identify with the prodigal? And you know what? Nobody raised their hand. I said, how many of you identify with the elder brother? And they all raised their hand. I said, can I use that? So Sunday, I said, you know, I've been preaching all week. And it turns out that you have a prodigal as your pastor. But it turns out that this interesting story was told about this men's Bible study. They all said they were elder brothers. So let me just ask you, how many of you fundamentally think of yourself as a prodigal, and how many of you fundamentally think of yourselves as the elder brother? About 10 people raised their hand for being the prodigal, and about, you know, multiple hundreds raised their hand for being the elder brother. And I said, you know, the thing that we're going to discover together is what is the gospel for elder brothers? It has to be the same party, but it's not under the same terms. It has to be through the gift of God's Spirit that brings the elder brother to himself, just as the prodigal had to come to himself. But what it is that's going to produce that is probably going to be different. It's going to be a longer road. It's going to be a probably more subtle transition. It's going to be about acknowledging and crediting aspects of responsibility and duty that are built into elder brother culture, the culture of the people that have been faithful and believe they have what they need. But somewhere, as far as I can see, you don't come to Jesus without being broken. And what that is going to be about is usually then not about some of the things that might break the prodigal, but more about simply coming to the end of their resources And the places that I've seen this happen the most, with some of the most elder brother-like people at First Press and other places, is when finally their own capacity is simply stripped of sufficiency. It may be their health, it may be their own marital circumstance, it may be their children, it's frequently their children or their grandchildren. These things that bring them to the end. It has been, in some cases, fear around things like the implications of 9/11, in some cases, these economic days, right? All those moments that can sort of appear. We have to be ready to actually step into the crack that we may be given. And this is where pastoral care, again, becomes so significant. I have to be prepared to actually increase the person's dissonance, not cover it over. My pastoral tendency can be to say, there's a fissure in your life. Let me smooth it over and make sure that you know that there's comfort in your dissonance. Instead, what I need to do is go, wow, that must really hurt. Let's look at that. And there are people on our staff who are amazing at this. And I have learned so much from my associates about watching them just go, whoa, like, let's go closer to that pain. That'd be a really good thing to do. Let's go closer and feel what that's really like. Gosh, let's just sit with that for a while. And when that happens, it changes the terms. And there begins to be the possibility, I think, in that brokenness of discovering a gospel for the elder brother.